Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up with our most recent podcasts. We most recently discussed The Apartment. Before that was Tully. Before that was Rashomon. And before that was Mission Impossible Fallout. I've also written a handful of things recently that you can read if you like Zach Lowe, the film Support the Girls, or the film Tully, and didn't find our podcast sufficient. Anyway, themacguffinman.com.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Alex.
Margaret. Here we are. Three first names now.
There we go. Got them out of the way.
We're talking about Margaret, the Kenneth Lonergan film.
Yeah, the 2005/2011 Kenneth Lonergan film.
Yeah, so written in like 2003 for the most part, shot in 2005, anticipated release 2007, actual brief release 2011, and then the cut that we're talking about was released in the summer of 2012.
And what's the proper terminology for the one that we're talking about?
Kenneth Lonergan refers to it as his director's cut. In just in talking about director's cuts and all that stuff, he used the example, it's more Blade Runner than Apocalypse Now Redux, where Redux was like Francis Ford Coppola going back in a long time ago, whereas the director's cut of Blade Runner is like what Ridley Scott always wanted to do. And Lonergan says that what exists in this cut, he's 75% happy with. And he says the best you can get to is like 85, so which is a very Kenneth Lonergan thing to say. Well,
judging from what I know about him, I would have put that number closer to 25, but I'm happy this exists as it is. I mean, I haven't seen any of the versions, so I can't speak to that, but just in reading about some of the prolonged litigious history of this movie, which I don't know how much we're going to get into.
I feel like we have to talk about it for a bit, but it's so nuts and bolts, it's not going to last. It's not going to be a long conversation.
Yeah, but just the idea that, you know, if this is 75 of 85, I'm happy, especially because if this is a movie that is written and directed by the same person, then it's, you know, when you have a script and then you have a screenwriter and you have a director who are two different people, and you can kind of argue about which vision is truer, even though, you know, we understand it as a director's medium for the most part. Mm-hmm. When they're the same person, there's kind of no argument there. And you can have the versions that were put out because they needed to put something out or they wanted a certain runtime. But when it comes down to the most accurate vision of the one person who, you know, is mostly responsible for this, and that's not to, you know, denigrate anybody else who obviously had a hand in making this movie, mm-hmm. but it's just something else when someone who is this involved in it says this is the right one. I'm happy to be able to see that version of it.
Yeah, for sure. And but also it's all dependent on how the specific artist works, you know. Like Kenneth Lonergan is you know, by all accounts, people that produce his films and all that stuff and will try to protect his films think he should be the one directing them. I mean, the story about Manchester by the Sea was that he was hired to write that on assignment for Matt Damon to direct, and Matt Damon read the script and was like, no, you have to direct this. This is like, I'll screw this up. This is too Kenneth Lonergan. And but some people require that a more collaborative partnership. I mean, the one that comes to mind is the Coen brothers, and that almost doesn't count because they're just, they've been described.
One person.
Yeah. I mean, they've been described as like by countless actors on their sets, like one person, like they're clearly thinking the same thing without speaking to each other, you know? But just a lot of, some people need like a more collaborative relationship. I think Charlie Kaufman's a good example. It's, I mean, just in the fact that he, I mean, he didn't want to direct Synecdoche, New York. He only did it because somebody had to and Spike Jonze was unavailable, you know? So, like, I see what you're saying, but I do. Since film is a collaborative medium and the older I get, the more I realize how important the contributions of other human beings can be. I feel like that bears mentioning, despite the fact that, you know, Lonergan films feel so much like Lonergan films. And also because I also say that because I feel like maybe he could use a collaborator on this movie. Visually, this movie is so boring. Oh my God. It's a fantastic movie. I want to be very clear about that. I like all of his films. Manchester by the Sea is at least like well shot. I think him working with Jodie Lee Lipes, I don't quite know how to pronounce his or her last name, who also shot Trainwreck and is just in general very talented. I think that was a good like find, whereas his films Margaret and You Can Count on Me are both pretty bland visually.
Do you mean in the sense that it looks like someone who came from theater is now shooting on cinema? Yeah.
Yeah. I always go back to the this is something you said on like one of our first podcasts about how you looked at movies for a long time. And I'm sure everybody does until a certain point in their life when they sort of start to understand more about the filmmaking process, where it's just like they're books that have been translated to visuals, you know, and there's not much other than the words, you know, and some people still only watch movies for stories. I mean, most people still only watch movies for the actual story and don't put as much thought into the visuals. It's just, as somebody who often points out, this is what's good visually about this movie, and it's kind of the one thing I'm good at on this podcast, maybe the one thing that I can consistently bring. I have almost nothing to say about that for this movie.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a few things I want to touch on there. Do you want to get to anything about the visuals? Do you want to get the kind of production side of this, or pre-production post-production side out of the way?
Yeah, I think we should.
Okay.
And I will say, like, this movie is so expansive. There are so many speaking parts.
I think 51 is the number I saw, which I didn't doubt, so
yeah,
that says something.
Yeah, exactly. That was definitely a draft of the screenplay. I'm not sure if that was like what like, you know, the count them up, if we were to actually count all the speaking parts, well, on screen speaking parts. There's so many off screen, but yeah, the 51 definitely sounds at least close, right? And that's really saying something. And knowing that this was done with a budget of 12 something million dollars, and just how quickly you eat through money making a film, double, like, add into that you are trying to make a geographically accurate New York film, you know, like they're shooting in the locations that they say they're shooting in for the most part. That was something that Lonergan, being born and bred in New York, really wanted to do, is to make a movie where if someone goes around the corner on this street, turns onto this street, it's the actual street that you would turn onto as opposed to cheating it.
I read that too, and it's something that just such a large percentage of people seeing this movie won't be able to appreciate, myself included.
Yeah.
But just for the sense of realism and just how much more difficult that is, as you said, for your budget and for locations and for shooting and scheduling and all that kind of thing. I can imagine it's something that, as you said, was very important to him, and wouldn't register to so many people.
Yeah, exactly. And just in general, it feels like they didn't have anywhere near the amount of time that they would have wanted to actually shoot this movie, you know, like some of the performances are kind of lacking, and it feels like you just kind of had to move on at a certain point. And again, I'm saying all the things I don't like about this movie, because I have so many things I do like about this movie. Like, this is I've said it to you many times before, this is easily one of my favorite movies of the decade. And I just think it's fantastic and so expansive. And what I was getting at with the expansiveness of it is, it feels like the movie I'm obsessed with the movie the director makes after their biggest success. This feels like the movie he should have made after Manchester by the Sea. And he just was just like, no, I'm going to make this like super broad, how could anybody ever do this sort of movie that you can only do if you have like a certain amount of acclaim. But I'm going to do that, and then I'll win an Oscar on the next one. You know, like, it's just, I don't know. It's so interesting to me.
And do you say that because it's kind of sprawling geographically and just structurally? You know, Manchester by the Sea isn't a fast-paced film by any means. But I mean, this has like that much more room to breathe, and these things that you could see why a studio would say we don't need this 6-minute piece because it drives nothing forward about the plot. Like, is that what you mean?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first hour of this movie, with the exception of the bus accident scene, is pretty much just Lisa's Anna Paquin's character, our main character, just kind of living her life. You know, it doesn't even pursuing, righting her wrong doesn't begin until hour two, you know? And there's no real, the structure of the story doesn't really fall into three acts in a way that you would feel like a regular movie would. And the fact that characters just come and go, like, I feel like Matt Damon is gone for almost two full hours at one point of this movie, you know? or Mr. Aaron, I guess is his character's name. And I don't know. It's just, there's just something about the feel of this movie that is so, so unique. And you kind of have to like really commit yourself to being like, okay, I'm just going to live in this. And I find it very rewarding. And also it was incredibly helpful that I had no idea what I was getting into the first time I watched it, and just found myself being like, okay, so this is a teen movie. And then about an hour through the movie, I'm just like, okay, so now we're like, this is just a movie built around this one incident that happens. And then it's just a person going around and 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 trying to find an answer and coming back with nothing. And that's the structure of a movie I can really get down with if it's written well. You know, it's I don't know. I think about this movie all the time because just in general, the theme of this movie reminds me of any like my own life just so frequently. Because it reminds me of anybody's life, because there are no answers, is what I'm getting at. We're all doomed.
Yeah, and I mean, broadly, would you say that is the theme of this? Because you said theme as though there might be one kind of kernel at the center of this that you think this is trying to say, and for a, you know, kind of a airy sort of slice of life movie, maybe, that that is kind of resistant to it being about, you know, a seven word like, mm-hmm. you know, truism or something.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you can boil this movie down to and it's a very meandering version of this sort of storyline, but like somebody realizing that there's just every ounce of humanity confuses you, and you're just trying to find the one person you can hold on to, or anybody that you can relate to, and you hold on to them and try and keep them close. And it's the mother-daughter relationship of the movie. If there's one like through line of the movie, and that wouldn't come up in a plot description, you know, but that's sort of the, if I had to boil it down to one sentence, I would say mother-daughter relationship about trying to find the one person you can relate to in the world. In a world of mystery.
Hmm. Or put on the list of bus movies that I was directed to on Google when I was searching.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Or is it This and Speed?
Yeah, there's a series of things. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression. Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And I think that's the relationship we get the most of in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, I feel like if we were to do the screen time math, I feel like Joan and Lisa would have a much closer number on the screen time counter than you would think. You know, it feels like Joan isn't in the movie that much, but as somebody who's now seen this movie like five times, the more you watch it, the more present she feels throughout the movie.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking of boiling it down, I mean, it's, I guess the log line is this, that Lisa witnesses an accident and tries to right a wrong that she made initially, which again doesn't really get us that much closer to what I think we're trying to get from this movie. And I guess this is almost goes without saying, because it really is hammered home very clearly. And I think, you know, I think we both read that New York article about this movie with Kenneth Lonergan, and he says
the tumultuous masterpiece or whatever.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yeah, that's like the article about this movie. It's a it's a New York Magazine piece, I think.
Okay.
Essentially the same thing. We're not New Yorkers. Yeah. We don't know the fucking difference.
Yeah, that's right. That's, as we stated earlier, this might be West 76th Street as well. just that he kind of takes pride in saying he doesn't like to hammer points home or kind of force feed the audience anything. But this really seems to be a movie or kind of a meditation on how human lives interact with each other. And, you know, that's really spelled out almost with those exact words at one point that, you know, you feel like you're the star of the world because you're always watching the world pass through your eyes and you only ever see what is happening to you. And you can, you intellectually, you know that there's 7 billion other lives going on, but that's just, it's so hard to fathom that because you're just so attached to yours. And it, I just think that's the central thing. I mean, I think you're right that the central relationship would be the mother-daughter, and especially we get that because the film ends with seemingly an emotional breakthrough that they have with each other. Mm-hmm. But this movie's so much about the way people's lives bounce off each other and trying to see yourself as just a tiny piece of everybody's life and not the star in your own life the way that we're most adept at feeling it. Like, this is a movie about Lisa that's called Margaret. This is a movie named after someone who is not a character in this movie. I mean, I know she comes up in the poem, which plays a very small part in this movie anyway. But I think that, I mean, that I think is at the core. And I know I'm not, this isn't a brilliant observation. As I said, it's really spelled out at certain times. But to me, that's what this is. And I think, you know, you said that there's nothing interesting going on visually. And I think that there's some filmmaking stuff that goes very much with that theme that I thought was some of the better filmmaking stuff. I mean, we obviously know he can write some good dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I haven't said much about how I feel about this movie. I think it was really, really, really good.
I'm very excited about this news.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought. I would have thought. And
I always anticipate, especially when it's a movie like this that I really care about and have like actively said to you, yo, you should watch this movie sometime because I like it a lot. Anytime it's something like that, I'm always just like Tully is another perfect example. I'm just anticipating like what you're not going to like about the movie and just very worried that you won't, you know? And this was 100% one of those movies. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll say that with those kinds of movies, you know, everybody wants some or some of these ones that are a bit meandering. Mm-hmm. That, and this comes up in our discussions of it, that when you buy into it, then a lot of the little things that might be bad or neutral suddenly become great. And I think I was just on board with a lot of so much of this movie already. Yeah. That there's these examples of the rules of filmmaking being broken throughout this movie that I just really loved and was really excited by instead of feeling ambivalent or negative about.
Cool. Yeah. Can you think of an example off the top of your head of something like that?
Yeah. There's one. I guess they go to the restaurant together a few times, but I think it's Lisa, her mother, Joan, and Ramon.
Yeah.
And, you know, as the camera
moves you mean Lisa, Emily?
Yes.
Joan,
yes,
and Ramon?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Emily's Jeannie Berlin's character.
Yeah. Who is a great Allison Janney partner who I never really saw. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
That when and this is done in other things, but I just think it's really effective in this one because of the themes of the movie, but how much the audio will change as the camera moves around. And
yeah.
This is so much a movie about other people's lives affecting you or kind of, you know, we see this in the over-talking and the overheard conversations, but just the audio of different conversations. And it sometimes it's pretty jarring and sometimes you find yourself fighting to hear the dialogue you know you're supposed to be hearing because it's the characters you've met already. I just think stuff like that, again, because of its thematic significance, is one that I really liked. And, you know, a movie that I think is just trying to be artsy, you can do that. You know, it's, oh, this is going to make it a bit more difficult. And I would either dislike it or, you know, not really care. But because I liked this movie as much as I did. That stuff just, it drives home what the movie is trying to say in general, and just feels a lot more realistic, and lots of stuff like that I really liked. And yeah, just the idea of how big the world is, and these shots of airplanes, or when, you know, we pan from two people having a conversation instead of taking the short kind of interior route. We do the, you know, the 90 degree camera pan, we do a 270 degree shot of the city, and just get reminded of that it's New York, and that there's all these different people, and that there's traffic, and there's planes and helicopters. As I said, just because of what this movie is trying to say, that stuff just, it makes it better instead of trying to be needlessly artistic or, you know, pad the timing, which I don't think this movie needs any timeline padding at all.
So, yeah.
Or any runtime padding.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I certainly agree with you about the audio. That's like the filmmaking thing I love about this movie. It's amazing. So I counted how many of those conversations there are as I was watching it. There are 27 in total. And I'm anytime you could hear multiple conversation, like off-screen conversations simultaneously, I counted it as one. You know, it's just sort of like an instance of off-screen dialogue, basically, of people that you never actually see.
Like Lisa's breakup.
Yeah, over Lisa's breakup. Yeah, exactly. So there's that guy on the cell phone, and then the two old women at a different table. Like, you hear them simultaneously, but I counted them as one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
15 of those instances are in the first 40 minutes. So, like, it really, they really, like, just because I remembered it being absolutely constant, and it's only when I actually started to do, I guess, the Margaret equivalent of analytics is like that I started to realize that it's just they do such a good job of setting that up, or Lonergan does such a good job of setting that up, that I just remembered it as being absolutely constant. And it's also just something that with the exception of The Wire, I can't think of external conversations mattering as much to the movie. And I mean, they were much more muted in The Wire, but it's still very present, and there's no conversation about The Wire that's complete without talking about the amount of care put into that sound design. And I feel like that's the same with Margaret, and I definitely agree with you on that. I think my complaints with the visuals are more just like just the shots are bland. You know what I mean? Like, I like all of those, the rotating camera shots that you're talking about, and the reminders of the planes and all the other people in the city, and the slow motion shots of people on the streets at the beginning. I definitely like all of the ideas of those shots. I just think visually the execution of them is very bland, you know?
Yeah. Like the decision was the correct one to do a shot like that, but the composition of those shots, and I'm assuming you think of just most of the shots in general, isn't that inspired.
No, exactly. And again, that's why I sort of said, so what I did upfront about the limitations of making this movie, and just in general the ambition of this movie, and the ambition of making this movie on this budget, and you know, as somebody who's never made a movie but like knows enough about filmmaking to sort of at least be able to add up certain things and be like, okay, well, that sounds crazy, that doesn't sound possible to make this movie for that. I don't know, I just felt that it was important to mention, and it's why the ambition of the film is notable to me.
Yeah, and you got to add up Matthew Broderick's juice box budget. Which...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I did want to ask you this.
About our new punk band, Matthew Broderick's Lunch of Sadness.
Did you have any fun watching this movie?
I mean, there are parts that are funny. Not certainly, like... So that was kind of one of my main concerns about this movie, is that I was concerned you would come into it remembering the laughs from Manchester by the Sea, which I know that sounds insane, but Manchester...
Our other band name.
But like, I mean, we've talked about this, we must have on the podcast, about how obviously Manchester by the Sea is a deeply tragic film, but... It's when the scenes aren't tragic, it's pretty funny, you know? And there's plenty of chuckles to be had throughout the movie. basically between the relationship that Lucas Hedges and Casey Affleck have. This movie, there's much fewer of them, but I feel like they still exist. The gym teacher, the pan over the guy just ogling the gym teacher while she's stretching is pretty funny. I didn't write them down. There's like five or six times where I definitely chuckle in this movie. The Lisa and her brother arguing for sure. But I don't, yes, I had fun watching this movie, but it's a kind of fun that Kenneth Lonergan would identify with, in that I sat still for 3 hours and had a very interesting thought experiment happen in front of me. I really enjoyed it, but I didn't feel like I was watching Ocean's 11. I will say that, you know?
Yeah.
So to answer your question, like there's nothing more fun than watching a movie I love, and I love this movie, but it's not like I'm rolling around like throwing confetti in the air celebrating this film as it progresses, you know?
Yeah, and I thought that sometimes I describe films as humorless, and yeah, for all the gravity of this movie, I did have some good laughs.
Yeah.
And I mean, you throw Culkin into the mix and oh. I'm on board.
Oh, the Culkins are great. Rory is, he's like 8 and You Can Count on Me, which I watched again the other night, and it's just so much fun. And I also like, there's a movie last year called Columbus that I actually recently wrote about, that I liked a lot, and Rory Culkin's in that as like a 20-year-old, and it's just really interesting to see him again and still be a huge fan of him. But yeah, we're a pro Culkin podcast.
Yeah, and I haven't seen You Can Count on Me, and after watching this, I realize I kind of don't have a choice now, and I absolutely have to. But yeah,
it's more Manchester by the Sea than Margaret, I will say that.
Okay,
yeah, like just in the scope, it's a small town relationship movie, basically.
Okay,
with my girl Laura Linney, who's fucking fantastic in it.
Our girl Laura Linney.
I didn't realize this was a friend of the podcast. I thought it was a friend of me.
Laura Linney podcast as yeah. Well.
Great.
I am enjoying the choices that Kenneth Lonergan is making for himself as an actor. And him as the dad. And I don't even know if he would consider himself to be like a bad father in this movie. Mm-hmm. But Mexico's off and I'll talk to you whenever.
Yeah.
Just such a highlight for me.
Oh, yeah. It's like that whole scene's just like hard to watch. And I always have, for whatever reason, the scene when he's talking to Lisa earlier on the phone when Lonergan's new wife comes in, whose name I forget. And then he's like, Lisa is just explaining to him that I lied on my statement, all of these very important things. And he's like trying to have two conversations at once. And he's not the best actor, so that's frustrating me as well. And just that sort of situation when somebody's just like trying to navigate two separate conversations simultaneously and navigating them both extremely haphazardly, like that just always drives me bananas. And that happens like 20 times in this movie. It might happen 20 times with just Jeannie Berlin, you know, where somebody's just yelling over somebody else. That kind of bothers me as well. Like I view them as cousins in the same family, you know, and I don't know, just all of that. I mean, it's part of the theme of the movie is that everybody gets ignored, but still, it's just hard. It's just hard to watch.
Anyway. Yeah, and I think the same thing with the near the end, the conference calls with with the lawyer, and about kind of everybody being happy and some people feeling like that they literally aren't being heard in this phone conversation. Yeah, that's something else too. And I saw him kind of talk about just that this is a movie that, you know, we've talked about the way you interact with different people, and that you kind of see this linear narrative to your life, but it very much weaves in and out of all these other people's lives, and you kind of show up or you're not noticed. And it's just the way that this movie puts Lisa into all these different places that she's never been, you know. Mm-hmm. She's never been to a police station, and she's never been to a lawyer's office. And he was particularly vocal about the language that people use. And just, you know, you were saying that you're more of a visual person, and I see myself as more of a words person, and that they, you know, she's trying to keep up with the language, and people are always asking what things mean, and that there's, you know, there's legal jargon, but we see it in other fields of people just kind of having to ask what things mean, and things that you take for granted as part of your everyday dialogue and your everyday existence as something so foreign to somebody. And just that idea of kind of moving through different physical spaces, like a police station and like a lawyer's office that you've never been through before. It just goes hand in hand with the jargon and the way that people speak in these different locations, and people of different ages and people of different professions and, you know, different walks of life, you know, all speaking English, but having a difficult time understanding each other.
Yeah, exactly. Just because, as you said, the, depending on the job, there's just different jargon that, that people are, certain people are more adept at because, you know, they're, they make a living being adept at said jargon in the case of lawyers. Yeah. And I think that goes hand in hand with something else I like about this movie with, which is all of the people that Lisa decides to confide in, because she doesn't feel like she gets the right answer from anybody. And I really enjoy all of those sort of, there's no like, I don't know, there's no scene of Lisa being like, oh, I should go confront the bus driver. It's just sort of like, we just see her going on this trip. Like, she, you know, we see the process of her getting his address and all that stuff, just as we see the process of her getting in contact with Emily by calling Abigail. But
she doesn't seem intent on it being confrontational. Right?
No, like, she doesn't seem on any, like, she seems...
Like, let's share the same space and something will happen. Like, not even something will happen, but she just feels compelled to do it.
Exactly. Like, she's asking questions as opposed to demanding answers. Like, there's something in her that's like, I just feel there's something in me that I need to say, or like a question I need to pose. And I feel like maybe this is the right person to pose that question to. But she's never like, no, I need an answer, like fist beating on the table sort of thing. Like, I mean, there's a very notable instance late in the film when she yells into a speakerphone, but that's just sort of all of her frustration of not getting the answer that she has wanted this whole film, just bubbling up inside of her and sort of making her intentions very loudly known, or the reasoning behind the search very loudly known. But yeah, she's, I don't know, it just all comes from a place of inquisitiveness and wonder. And that sounds much more saccharine than this movie is, but that is where it comes from. It's just somebody who doesn't know something, or doesn't know the answer to something, but believes that the answer can be found, and is just a smart, intelligent, hardworking person who's willing to try to find that for a very long time, and or in a what amounts to a pretty exhausting search. And I don't know, it's just that whole journey is just really fascinating to me, you know. And you never feel like there's something that Lisa's thinking that you don't know. Like there's, like, she's hiding a secret from the audience or whatever, or there's just something that Lonergan's choosing not to tell us. But you also, I don't know, there's something so real about the character of Lisa to me, just in the way that she simultaneously feels like a teenager and also feels like a character in this movie that is just so precise and so not, doesn't remind me of my own life in like the actual structure of it, you know, but just in the existence of the way this character thinks, I find really interesting.
Yeah. And yeah. So a few things there. I don't know if we should save this for the end, but just the idea of what her motivation truly is, I think, is something that is a bit up in the air. And I don't mean that in a negative way. And something I wanted to say about what you're getting at about, you know, these not, you know, pounding her fist on the table demanding an answer. It just doesn't seem like she, like, just from a screenwriting perspective, it's not, she needs to go to this place to acquire this info. And then, you know, the next domino is, okay, now she has this information, so she can use that to do this, right? Like, that's just not the way that this feels. And it does just kind of have this broad sense of, I need to find my way back to this part of my life. You know, it's just this whole thing, again, from sort of a screenwriting A to B to C to D to, you know, conclusion. There's this lack of streamlining. And I think when you say this feels like your life, even though this isn't an experience that you've had, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm.
Nor is it like a type of person I've ever really spent a lot of time with. Like these like rich, weird two-teacher classroom high school students. Like that's... I don't know. It's just I've never seen this world outside of the movies.
Yeah, and I just think that you have just the way that it does bounce around and kind of seemingly directionless, even though we know that we're always moving towards something generally. Like, you know, you have your professional life and you have your whatever romantic life or your family life and social life and creative life, or, you know, all the different sort of aspects of what you do. And they feel they kind of feel separate if you think of them individually, but you're the sinew, I guess, holding it all together. And when you spend time in those, you know, different compartments of your life, they all affect each other, or they reveal something about you, and it's hard to see the way that those bounce off each other. And this just seems like a movie of Lisa, you know, being Lisa in every aspect of her life, and she's, you know, pretty young at that time. People are still kind of developing who they are and still figuring things out.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And I guess that's sort of this movie, and maybe it's the longest version of it, you know, is the one that I saw. But there is this, you know, sprawling is a word we've used a bunch, but this sprawling nature to it, and seemingly disconnected, seemingly maybe entirely unimportant, but it is this fleshing out of this character who just still kind of seems like an afterthought because of the way that this movie treats her, that she's not even the title of this movie, that so many things happen about other people and to other people, but she is not caught in the middle, because that makes it sound too passive, but this is her life, and that even though she's not the star of all these different things, and we're watching her mother's relationship, which, you know, tangentially affects her, but it's not necessarily about her. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just seeing so many sides of it, and sometimes at such a distance to her life, but we see the way that it kind of bumps into her eventually.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know. It's just, it's a hard movie to talk about. You know, like I feel like there are so many things that, like, I when I'm watching this movie, I'm just like, when I was watching it again last night or whatever, I was just like, oh, this is great, and this is great, and this is great, but it's all just like, it's just sort of like a feeling of that the movie just sort of grabs onto you and just sort of continues to hold you, like, and it's just a list of actions that happen without clear understanding why necessarily. A lot of the time, it's just a search for an answer to a question that isn't necessarily even said to us. It's just Lisa wants to feel like she's doing the right thing, and just learns how hard that is to do. And I think something that is really enjoyable for somebody who has seen the movie before is when watching it again, the first scene of the movie outside of the opening credits is Lisa picking up her test from Mr. Aaron, played by Matt Damon. And then he asks her to see him after class, and they have a conversation about how she's cheating, and she cheated on the test. And she basically justifies it to herself by saying, why does it matter? I'm not going to need this stuff in my life. Also, it's an open book test, which is basically like state-sponsored cheating anyway. Like, she's basically just justifying her actions. And I find that really interesting, because that's just the type of self-justification that she has existed in the world long enough for to like sort out. Like, that's a part of the world that she has learned how to navigate through, right? She knows how to sweet talk her teacher. I mean, let's just leave out all of the things that happen between them later, but like in this moment, she knows a way to talk to a teacher who accuses her of cheating, rightfully accuses her of cheating, and and get herself out of it without any repercussions. Because again, this is the type of jargon she knows. This is the part of the world that she knows. And then, as you mentioned, we spend most of the rest of the movie watching her go into other parts of the world that she doesn't understand, and trying to figure out, or trying to wrap her head around, the ways that other people who reside in these locations, their equivalent of high school, have figured out how to talk around certain things, or the way that the union argument is so important to Mark Ruffalo never having been fired despite having multiple bus accidents. He just gets moved around because his brother's a bigwig in the MTA. And her just sort of learning that other people will find ways to justify things to themselves, or find ways to manipulate the spaces that they occupy. And I think that what you're saying about Lonergan never really like hitting the nail on the head too many times, I think using the first scene to show that, I think, is just an absolutely fantastic choice that I know didn't register with me the first time I watched it. And I think it's something like that that really, I feel like, sits with you for the whole movie, despite the fact that you're just like, oh, a kid is, all right, so she cheats on her test. That's what we're supposed to know about Lisa from this. And she's sort of the smart talking teenager. But then you watch the rest of the movie, and again, whether or not you remember that scene at the end of it, it sort of sets the tone for what is to come, you know, and for all the conversations she's going to have with all of these different people. And she had a version of the conversation but she won it in the beginning. And then she just continues to, I mean, calling it win or lose is wrong for the conversations she has throughout the movie, but continues to not get what she feels like she wants, you know? And I just think that's a really interesting writing choice, a really smart writing choice.
And so do you think that this is a movie about her trying to do the right thing? Like, do you think that what happens is that she felt bad that she was dishonest about this bus accident because of her role in it, and it's a coming of age movie in the sense that she has to own up to something even though she could get away with it, but morally it's the right thing to do?
No, I don't think this movie is about doing the right thing or a desire to do the right thing. I do think it's a coming of age tale. I think the moment when she comes of age is realizing that you'll never understand anything about the world, you know, or never fully understand the world. Like, I think she, I don't know. It's sort of like you're at that point in your life when so much of what you do and where you have to go and all these things, she's 17, she's still in high school. Like, you just have a very regimented sort of life. Right. And you're right at the precipice of, potentially, like, you know, if you choose to move out and go to college, if you can pull that off, you're on the precipice of this world opening up, and this just this all happens to her in a very pointed way, you know, because she sees somebody gets hit by a bus, and then she's very affected by the trauma of that.
Scene's crazy.
Sorry?
That scene is crazy too.
Yeah, of course. And she's very affected by the fact that Monica, Allison Janney's character, her leg was severed by the sounds of things. She mentions that a couple times throughout the movie. But, you know, and naturally, a 17-year-old would deal with trauma, that she dies in her arms, all of these things. And she's certainly dealing with trauma and trying to figure out, you know, presumably, it would have come up at some point in this movie if this had happened before, or something like this had happened before. This is the first instance of real trauma that she's experienced. She doesn't quite know how to react to it. She's learning this as the world is about to open up to her. The world opens up in a totally different way. She sees the way that some sort of small action of her part by trying to wave down a bus driver who's wearing a cowboy hat can maybe kill a person, you know? And just this sort of, not necessarily even a ripple effect of your actions at all times, but a ripple effect of some of your actions some of the time can matter, or how you act in the world. And I this does sound like I'm saying she's trying to figure out how to do the right thing, but I just don't think that's what this movie is about. It feels like a movie about just trying to come to some understanding about why that ripple matters, you know, and how it affects other people. And then just coming to terms with the fact that more often than not, you can't really understand how that ripple affects everybody because everybody reacts to things in different ways. I think a very key aspect of the movie is that when Joan asks Ramon, do you think it's a problem that we seem to never agree on anything? And I mean, you know, maybe it's a problem, maybe it's not, you know, maybe you just get along and enjoy arguing with each other. That's entirely possible too. But it's just, Lisa repeatedly realizing she can't get enough of an answer. You know, she can't get like this full answer from anything. And even her relationship with her mother, I don't think the movie ends with it telling us that it's all going to be okay between them all the time for the rest of their lives. You know, they're going to have their ups and downs just like they do throughout this movie.
Yeah. I was going to say from what I've seen, it's probably not roses forever.
Yeah. But it's also like, this is the most difficult time of a mother-daughter relationship, you know, when the daughter is 17, and figuring out how open the world is about to be to her, you know? And I just sort of feel like I think she wants to do the right thing or wants to feel like she's doing the right thing, but I don't think that matters as much to her as the concept of feeling like she has an answer, you know? I don't know. Maybe that's a horrible explanation, and maybe that's backs up what I'm saying about I find this movie very difficult to talk about despite the fact that I adore it.
Yeah. No, and I think that makes sense. And I think that she is so, I mean, I'll say I really do enjoy a lot of the mother-daughter scenes.
Oh, they're fantastic.
You know, yeah, it's not just like argument porn, you know, it's I really do enjoy it a lot. And I think they're both, I'll say, pretty good in this movie. But I one thing that is kept coming to mind when you're talking about that is that Lisa, for how you know, she's articulate and smart and clearly doesn't have a problem with being the center of attention sometimes, and mm-hmm. wants her opinion heard, as we see, you know, several different in several different ways in this movie, mm-hmm. That she's not an actress in the school play, in that despite her mom's obvious talent and success in the world of theater, that she is on the technical side of things. And I that was something that I really liked, in that she's, you know, she clearly has some ability to be dramatic and verbose. And
I mean, there's a difference between being dramatic in your day-to-day life and being dramatic on command, but
yeah, I mean, doesn't mind being the center of attention.
Yes, okay, fair enough.
Or else you function in a different way.
Yes.
That it's, as you were saying, that it doesn't seem like she's concerned so much about kind of doing the right thing and being that person in the place to, you know, be the face of morality or consciousness or anything, but conscientiousness, but the way that, you know, she manipulates a lot of things in the runtime of this movie. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like mm-hmm. she's, you know, pulling strings behind the scene and, you know, being manipulative, just that things happen as a result of her actions. And I think that to have her, and we see very little of it. I mean, we spend some time in the world of the drama class, and there's some fun moments to be had there, some very serious moments to be had, and yeah. Culkin's once again for the win.
Of course.
I find that interesting, that it's not so much about, like, that is one thing where it's not about being the star, it's not about your life being the thing that matters, it's about there is this much bigger thing happening and you can do parts of it and not be seen, mm-hmm. But still have such a massive impact. And that just goes right with everything we've been saying about the mm-hmm. way that these people's lives and these interactions and the choices you can make can be so important, even if it's not two people arguing and one person being right and one person being wrong, and that being a very public, even if it's just the two of them, being a very public illustration of these two conflicting ideas, but that there is these kind of big things with many moving parts, and that is how life happens.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, somebody's got to point the lights where they're supposed to get pointed and do all of the little shit that nobody thinks about, or most people don't think about, you know. And on another technical director, or sorry, Lisa Cohen technical director note, I love the way she talks into the microphone. I think that's so funny. And so, okay, we're going to go back to one or whatever it is that she says, and just the tone of voice.
Please.
Yeah, exactly. As somebody who has been on those headsets and just the sometimes faked politeness that happens on those things, I just found that very entertaining. There was a real humorous version of reality coming through on there.
Yeah, and that is the public side of the private side too, right? Like, she's not, the audience isn't hearing that, but it's still kind of performative for all the people behind the scenes.
Yes, yeah, exactly. But it's the right kind of performative, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Falls in line. I don't really have much else to say. I do feel like, I don't know, it's worth pointing out the poem that this movie gets its title from is, yeah. It's just about somebody coming of age, and it just falls very much in line. I mean, maybe I'm just reading it. I've only read this poem because typically when I read a poem, it's because it's in a movie. And so like my perception of these poems is immediately colored by, I mean, Matthew Broderick's reading in this case, you know? And I just think it's worth pointing out just how, after you've seen Margaret, if you're reading that, you're just like, oh yeah, this is 3 hours and 8 lines, you know, like this sounds right. This sounds like what I watched. I did enjoy Joan's profession. I think that's something we haven't talked about and goes hand in hand with what you're saying about the Lisa as a technical director, is just the idea of, I mean, she wants to be seen. Like, that's her job, is to go to go out on a stage that people have paid money to sit in front of and perform for people and to be looked at. And it matters that she's in the same room as these people too, as opposed to just being like a screen actor. And I just think that that's really interesting. And when she first meets Emily, after Lisa's report card comes in and her grades aren't so hot, and so she's like, all right, introduce me to Emily, who you've been engaging in lawsuits with.
Chestnut.
Yeah, exactly. And just the conversation that they have, and the play has now seems to have been going on for long enough that when Lisa mentions that, oh, she's going to win all the awards, all these things, Joan just sort of, what she says right after that just really feels like somebody that's like in an interview for the press, as opposed to having a conversation with a person they've just met, or sorry, like a real person they've just met, not somebody that they've met and said, hey, I agree to tell you extremely personal things about myself, in the guise of an interview, you know? But it's just the way that, like, Emily says she doesn't care about the theater, and then Joan says something along the lines of, oh, well, you know, it's just nice. You can work in the theater for a long time and never get any recognition, and even though you don't necessarily do it for that reason, it is nice when people notice something that you've done. And I think that wanting to be seen is a theme throughout this movie that we haven't really touched on, and we've touched on about Lisa's performative streak just in her day-to-day life, but also I think the idea of wanting to be seen falls with what Lisa's doing, and just sort of wanting to stand out in some way, or feel like what she does is seen by somebody, you know? And I feel like that's the core action that Lisa, the thing that Lisa wants is for Mark Ruffalo, to get fired. You know, that's who she wants to be seen by. She wants to be seen as having this happen by this guy that she feels like killed Monica, or at least in tandem with her killed Monica. And I think the idea of having Joan be an actor whose job is specifically to want to be seen throughout the movie is really cool. I think it's a really good way to tie Joan and Lisa together. I think it's also a good way of showing that a lot of these concerns that happen when you're 17 might happen when you're in your 40s as well, or however old Joan is in this movie. And I just think that is a really nice choice, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's all I got for that. And also, I enjoy any time a piece of art comments on art in any way, and the conversation about Shakespeare and the consciousness of flies that happens in Matthew Broderick's classroom is very entertaining from that aspect.
Yeah, and that he's having a hard time losing control.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Are you surprised it's got no Oscar love?
No. I mean, this movie was pretty much an unseen. This was, like, released because a company felt like, I mean, it exists. We should release it, but we're not going to put any press into it. The only reason the cut that we see exists is because critics lost their shit for this movie, or the critics that saw it were really excited about it. Kenneth Lonergan has a lot of the right friends, specifically Martin Scorsese, and eventually Matt Damon would be very instrumental in Manchester by the Sea getting made. So it just sort of feels like this movie could have theoretically come out in its two-hour, 20-minute version and then just never been heard of again. But somehow, I think this was right at the, like, 6-week window when people in film studios thought people on Twitter mattered, and so we're listening to them. And I think Margaret was released in theaters at that point, and then Richard Brody wrote something about it, and then other people were like, cool, we'll see it when it comes out on Blu-ray, yada yada yada. And then eventually Fox Searchlight was like, well, I guess we'll put a 3-hour cut out into the world for with the Blu-ray as a bonus feature, you know, like we're watching a standard definition rip of this movie because no high definition rip exists, you know, and or no high definition rip of this cut exists. Even if you own the Blu-ray, you aren't the only high definition version, I believe, is the 220 cut. So it's just, I'm not surprised that this didn't get any Oscar love. I'm kind of surprised You Can Count on Me got a little bit of Oscar love. I like it, but it just doesn't feel like a movie that would break through in any way. And I don't know. I think that this movie exists in this form is good luck enough that I can't say I'm surprised that it didn't get any awards. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that something about, like you say, just this being what we have, I remember learning this about about pop music, that it has such a timelessness and placelessness to it, and that's which is kind of one of the trademarks of, you know, just pure commerce version of art. And this isn't that. Like, this has such a place to it, as we talked about. Like, yeah. It's so definitively New York, and it has such a tie to it. Like, it is just shortly after 9/11. Mm-hmm. But it's so interesting that it took as long as it did, and that it seems separate. You know what I mean? This seems like fresh after 9/11 by the time anyone was able to see it. It's different. And
I mean, even if it had been released in 2007, I feel like it would have felt like still kind of removed from, it still would have felt like this is a movie that took place 4 years previous, at least, you know?
Yeah, it still does feel, yeah, that's true. I think it would feel delayed in that sense, but I think at kind of any distance you take from that, mm-hmm. you know, it's not a period piece by any means, but it does feel like it, by the time it was released into the wild, it was already kind of fundamentally out of place. And I think that when we talk about the way that, you know, that things really matter, that, you know, within context and the different geographical spaces and the different kind of parts of your life that you occupy. I think it is, it's just funny to see this as kind of an artifact of this temporal location that quickly got away from itself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think there's a very hacky, point to be made that as you're talking about this movie being roundly ignored, I mean, for the most part, ignored by regular people, basically ignored by everybody that's not a film critic professionally, or somebody interested in the career of Kenneth Lonergan.
Because BBC had it as one of the top films of the decade in mm-hmm. a poll, but a poll of certain people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it's just sort of, I mean, just the light, the particular life that this movie had in that. I mean, who has seen this movie without some understanding of how difficult it was for this movie to actually be seen in any capacity, you know, and just the long protracted arguments that happened with Gary Gilbert, I think it is, Dan Gilbert's brother. And then it just sort of ended up just sort of getting dropped. It's like a drop in a bucket for Fox, for 20th Century Fox, or their indie offshoot Fox Searchlight in this case. And I think it's just kind of interesting that, you know, here we are, I guess 6 years after I saw it for the first time, and we're talking about it. There is people do still talk about this movie, again, within the same circles that I pointed out, like, and Lonergan's career, you know, he has an Oscar now, and things have gone all right for him since this movie, but nobody thinks of this movie when they think of Kenneth Lonergan. If they think of anything, they think of Manchester by the Sea. Chances are they say, who is that? I just think it falls right in line with the plot of the movie in that, or the theme of the movie in that, you can put all this effort in and still nobody's going to fucking see what you're doing, you know? And it's sort of this, I think like that's kind of the point of the movie. And it's also, it maybe proves how wonderful this movie is, but also it might just sort of be like, it's just an easy comparison to be made, you know? But I don't know. I think this movie proves its own point. You know, you can do all of this. You can work on something for years and years and years and nobody will see it. And nobody will understand the ramifications of the work that you've done, you know, whether it's art or trying to get a bus driver fired.
Yeah. And I think as depressing as that is, that does sum it up very well.
Well, when you see You Could Count on Me, which is just a rollicking good time. I mean, I guess of his three movies, that one might be the rollicking good time. But yeah, thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men, and be sure to check back next time.